This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Nicholas Lemon has been reporting on and studying American politics for a long time as a staff writer for the New Yorker. And now as this strange and very unnerving election season draws to a close, with the polls forecasting real trouble for Donald Trump, Nick has been considering a question that could be crucial to the American future. Will Trumpism outlast Donald Trump? Nick, let's begin with a very basic question. What is Trumpism?
Well, it's a little hard to answer because President Trump is such an erratic person. But it would have been easier to answer during the Republican primary season in 2016. So then you had the spectacle of Trump, in addition to being a super flamboyant and flamboyantly offensive former reality TV star, it wasn't clear that he even was a Republican and he was running for president. And he quickly carved out a sort of zone for himself, not just a personality zone, but a set of political stances that were really different from what you expected in a Republican. You know, pro-labor, pro-social security, no anti-government, I'm getting government out of your life, I'm limiting government, none of that kind of rhetoric. Nativist, nationalist, racist, and somewhat anti-business. A lot of anti-elite, but a lot of Wall Street bashing. So he was, you know, pitching himself to a certain kind of voter that wasn't in the Republican playbook.
Now, you say that Karl Rove told you, the Republican strategist who was so closely associated with George W. Bush, he said by the time you got to 2016, people just wanted to throw a brick through a plate glass window. What does that mean?
Well, I think it means, and, you know, I want to say this is a Democratic and Republican phenomenon, and it's a global phenomenon. It's not just about Trump. It's not just about the Republicans. It's not just about the U.S. People, well, let's go back. The turn of the millennium, there was this thing called the Washington Consensus, which you can find in, say, Tom Friedman's book. He has this phrase, the golden straitjacket, and he says everybody in the world just has to accept certain things, free trade, et cetera, and outsourcing of blue-collar jobs. A lot of people accepted that and thought, okay, fine, that's it. Both parties essentially agree on this. It became clear, especially after the 2008 financial crisis, that that view was just wrong. In terms of blue-collar workers, it was, you know, my job just went to China or wherever, or Mexico, so I feel abandoned and lied to. Then I think you and I both know a few people who are younger than ourselves. For them, the attitude is this whole narrative about the American dream, that was just never true for a generation or two. Hasn't been true. And that's not just why Trump happened, it's why Bernie happened, who seemed through two presidential election cycles just as unlikely as a political star as Trump.
Now, you say that Trump came along and exposed the inner hollowness of the Republican Party, quoting from the conservative Charles Kessler. What does that mean?
So the U.S. has had the same two dominant parties since 1860, and that's weird. It's a long run. Many times the run of either or both parties has been predicted to end, but they haven't ended. So each party has to be, if we have only two in a big, diverse country like this, a sort of bizarre coalition of people who don't have that much in common. The Republican coalition in recent years has been, to oversimplify, rich people and evangelical Christians. And, you know, the hollowness is they don't have anything in common. It sounds facile to say it, but it's true. The rich donor class in the Republican Party is not filled with people who think abortion is murder and things like that, and who go to church several times a week. And the evangelicals don't believe in, quote, neoliberalism. you know, Trump exploited that lack of commonality between the two sides of the Republican Party.
Yes, and in the campaign, recognized that evangelicals account for, in terms of people who identify as evangelical Christians, something like 80 million people.
Yeah, it's the huge majority of the Republican Party. It's the Republican base.
But he campaigned appealing to them. He campaigned as a populist. But as president, it turns out that he governed more conventionally as a conservative.
Right.
Tax cuts for corporations, conservative judges, law and order, and all the rest. Why did that happen?
Okay, so first you have to separate sort of the Trump show and what Trump actually did in the policy sense while Trump was president, and you're not allowed to talk about tweets and things like that. A massive tax cut, massive rollback of government regulations, and, you know, it's sort of a Reaganite policy, but way more than Reagan even dared to ask for, especially in terms of corporate tax cuts and rolling back environmental regulations, financial regulations. In the aggregate, these weren't to benefit the people who brought him into the Republican nomination and then into office. These weren't policies that helped all those, you know, displaced factory workers in the upper Midwest who really tipped the balance in the election. So then, back to your question, so why did he do this? And, you know, to do this piece, I talked to a lot of Republicans, and for them at least, you know, one might hear the answer, well, that's just because these rich Republicans control the party. I want to give a little more subtle answer than that. I don't think they control the party still electorally, but I do think they control the party in the sense that they have this huge apparatus they've built up over the years that has produced all of these people who are just waiting for a Republican to take office so they can serve in it. And Trumpism didn't have that. So he, combination of his personal lack of interest in the details of government and policy and the fact that the establishment that he spurned was able to say, we'll supply all your appointees and all your policies, that he just went with that.
So now we come to the crux of the matter. We're looking at polls. We're not going to predict anything because that's a fool's game, and we've been through that before. Nevertheless, the polls indicate that Donald Trump is in serious trouble, that his odds of winning are, let's just say, less than half. So you say that there are essentially three scenarios of post-Trump, that there is a remnant scenario for the Republican Party, a restoration scenario, and a reversal scenario. What do you mean?
Okay. So these are my categories, names I have given what I'm hearing from talking to a whole bunch of Republicans and conservatives. Remnant is the idea of Trumpists are a surrounded and shrinking and older minority, but by God, they're going to keep fighting, and they're just going to stay as much like Trump as possible and not try to be inclusive in any way. You know, if you want to look at Twitter and not look at Donald Trump's Twitter, look at Donald Trump Jr.'s Twitter or Senator Josh Hawley's Twitter. So that's remnant. Restoration would be the Republican Party wakes up as if after a bad dream, and the party can go back to its traditional role as the party of business, which it's been for at least 100 years. You know, tax cuts, free enterprise, strong military, the basic Reagan mix.
And the embodiment of this is somebody like Nikki Haley.
Yeah, I mean, you could envision somebody who would be sort of in line, like Pence or Pompeo. Or Nikki Haley is thought to be running, but positioning herself as, you know, the bearer of the Reagan tradition, the pro-business, optimist Republican. And it would be as if Trump never happened. The reversal is a kind of flipping of the historic roles of the two parties so that the Republican Party becomes more the sort of lower middle class, labor, at least non-public employee labor union party. It begins to attract a lot of Latinos, and it's kind of the party of the people. And the Democrats become the party of business, particularly, you know, high tech and financial businesses.
And the embodiment of this is Marco Rubio somehow, who talks to you at length.
Yeah, so let me say, I want to stress how, if this happened, first how close it is to happening and how weird it would be. It's not just in the U.S., but globally in the 20th century, politics kind of came down to, in democracies that were developed, there would be a party of labor and a party of business, basically. You find this all over the world. So for those roles to switch would be a big deal. The 10 richest congressional districts in the U.S., all 10 are represented by Democrats. 44 of the 50 richest are represented by Democrats. The biggest business sector in the country, tech, is clearly affiliated with the Democrats and is getting bashed by Republicans all the time. Wall Street is not as uniformly Republican as it always was, and in some campaigns has been majority Democratic. And the Democrats dominate among college-educated voters, which is not the historical situation. So somebody like Rubio thinks, I can build a Republican Party that has a more sort of open, inclusive, less negative rhetoric. It's very focused on the middle part of the country. This new kind of Republican would reach out to the less populated areas and say, you know, if you are just a regular church-going person who lives a local life, wants a job, and wants a party that cares about you, we're your party.
And what is the likeliest outcome of these three scenarios for the Republican Party? What do you see as the likeliest outcome and why?
If I had to bet, I would bet that the Republicans will go with the restoration scenario, which probably isn't the smartest one for them. But that's just because the whole office holder and leadership part of the party is so trained in that and steeped in that for decades. And I think it's very easy to go back to the mistakes of 2016.
Yeah, but what happens to the vaunted base? This is tens of millions of people, not just people who come out to Trump rallies, but people who have stayed with him despite everything, despite Twitter, despite things that they find offensive or rude or misogynist or racist. Obviously, there are many who find that attractive.
If the Republicans go with restoration, I think the Democrats, if they're smart, will go after some of the Trump voters, remembering, you know, that many of them voted for Obama. You know, when Dr. King made his great speech in 1965, he said, essentially, the reason that poor whites in the South are racist is they've been distracted away from their true economic interests. And that was said in a spirit of optimism that they could be brought back to attend to their true economic interests. So I think the Democratic Party, if they attend to the economic interests, which they haven't done so well for the last 20 years, could lure back a lot of people who voted for Trump. And it's not useful to say, those people are just racist, forget about it. I think people have good and bad in them.
Nick, in closing, I can't help but ask, we've been discussing, is there Trumpism after Trump? What is for Trump after this? What do you think, what is the afterlife of Donald Trump if in fact he loses this election?
Wow. Well, every morning and every night I walk my dog and I talk to my neighbors. Not one believes that Trump will voluntarily leave office. So that's one scenario, is he will declare martial law and just remain our president for the rest of his natural life.
Which you see as a reasonable scenario? Do you think it's possible? No.
I hope it's not possible, and I don't think it's. When I argue with these people, I say, you know, the folks who have brought that off, they have, like, for instance, the uniformed military on their side, yeah, like Sisi in Egypt, and he doesn't seem to have that. So I guess what he would do is, he seems not to be a shy, retiring type and isn't going to, you know, go home and paint oil paintings of his feet like George W. Bush has. And he'll find a way to remain in the spotlight, maybe dream of a restoration of Trumpism. I can't imagine we've seen the last of him.
Nicholas Lemon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Lemon is a professor of journalism at Columbia and a staff writer for many years at The New Yorker. And you can find his essay about the Republican Party after Trump at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The coronavirus is hitting yet another peak. Cases are rising in so many parts of the country, and Europe is also battling a resurgence. The last 7 months have lasted half a lifetime, and yet it feels like the pandemic is beginning all over again. Staff writer Jennifer Gonerman talked recently with one of the people who witnessed this whole tragic episode in our history up close. His name is Terrence Lane, a bus operator in New York City. Now, transit employees were among the hardest hit of all essential workers in New York. More than 120 have died from COVID. And yet all the same, Terrence Lane kept showing up for his shift, day after day, even as the city streets went quiet.
So we just passed the Museum of Natural History at 79th and Central Park West, you know, with that eyesore in the front, that statue of Teddy Roosevelt with the Native American and the African walking alongside him. You know, that's New York City's version of the Confederacy or a Confederate symbol. And people, you know, want to insist that that's not a symbol of white supremacy, but if that's not a symbol of white supremacy, I don't know what is.
In September, as the weather began to cool, Lane talked to us while riding on one of his regular routes on the west side of Manhattan.
You know, but you would see activity in front of the museum. In March, nothing. Museum is closed, it's empty. You know, just a feeling of desolation, almost apocalyptic in nature, where there's something happened and chased everybody out of the city.
Terrence Lane is a longtime bus operator in New York City, 21 years on the job. When I met him this past spring, he was working out of the Manhattanville Bus Depot, which is a bus depot on the west side of Harlem. And he's the chief shop steward there for his union, Local 100. The first time I saw Terrence Lane was actually in a video that I saw on the website for the union. And it was a video he had also posted on a few Facebook groups for city transit workers.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. I just want to share a few thoughts with you this morning.
He recorded this video when he was on a layover on March 23rd. He had propped up his phone in the window of the bus facing himself, and he was giving a sort of 2-3 minute speech to his colleagues, his co-workers, really trying to rally the troops.
However, we just have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that sometimes the only recognition you're going to receive is from the woman and man reflected back to you in the mirror as you are preparing for work to enter into this virtual hot zone. And know that that person staring back at you is a human being with guts and moxie and courage and dignity and self-respect. And sometimes that recognition is just gonna have to be enough. But if no one else thanks you and no one else recognizes you, know that I do.
I always felt like New York City's transit workers don't get nearly the amount of attention or recognition or really appreciation that they deserve. I mean, in a lot of ways, the subways and the buses are really the lifeblood of New York City. You know, he saw it all. In March, he had passengers coughing in the back of the bus. You know, he saw the stress on their faces as people were losing their jobs, getting more and more frustrated. You know, the worst of the pandemic as it was impacting people's daily lives.
Please exit through the rear door.
Yeah, it was a pretty macabre experience. One day, you know, it was almost overnight. One day you're going from full ridership to operating buses that are empty. Especially in mid-March, after the pause orders began, you may go the whole route and may not pick up more than 15 or 20 people the entire route. As we reached the apex or the high point, the most critical point of the pandemic,
the exit through the rear door,
and people were out of work, after a few weeks, food pantries that weren't unusual. What became unusual was the lines. The lines of people became longer, far longer than they used to be. They were wrapping themselves around the block.
What was it like for you personally to be operating a bus during the lockdown when so many other, you know, workers in New York City were obviously staying home? And some had left the city altogether. What was it like for you to be driving a bus? What were you seeing? What was the experience like?
You know, we had never operated in a hot zone before. We had never operated through this kind of plague. And so the steps and measures that we needed to take us to take in order to protect ourselves, that became a job. You know, you had to watch everything you touch, and we were wearing gloves, and we were wearing masks, and we were disrobing before we entered our homes, just traveling to and from work, and doing our jobs became tantamount to being in a war zone. And even as you forge ahead, you're seeing some of your fellow coworkers, you're seeing your coworkers, some of them fall to this disease. And we didn't feel that the senior management had done enough to protect us.
What Lane is talking about here is the fact that in early March, his employer, the MTA, prohibited transit workers from wearing masks on the job.
We asked for masks, they said no. When we asked or said that we wanted to wear our own masks, they told us that we couldn't do that because the mask was not part of the uniform that goes along with the title, which we thought was absurd.
It's worth noting that at this point in early March, the CDC was not recommending that healthy people wear masks. But some of the city's transit workers wanted to wear masks, and they were terrified. Their union, Local 100, pushed back, and the MTA reversed course pretty quickly. But it was not until late March that they announced they were going to start supplying PPE to their workers. And by the time that actually happened, some transit workers had already died.
We felt that we were relegated to being the proverbial canary in a coal mine. And we are still pretty furious about that.
At this point, how many people do you think you know who died of COVID-19?
I don't know if I had to make a guess. You know, I've been reluctant to actually sit down and try to count, but 30 people.
Between the end of March and early June, so over about 10 weeks, over 120 New York City transit workers died of COVID. That was a significantly higher number than other city agencies, than firefighters, for example, or the city's police officers.
We just crossed 135th. Besides us, there were only three customers on the bus. This is very unusual. This is mid-morning on a Saturday. If all the stores were open and if everything was operating as it was pre-COVID, there would be quite a few people on this bus. At the height of the pandemic, those of us who were still out here were essential workers. We had to be out here. And so there was a feeling of camaraderie among those of us who had to be out here, and an understanding that what we were doing was vital. And we were supportive of one another. When the city began to reopen and non-essential people or workers began to come back into the system, things began to change. And there were those, of course, who thought that mistreating a bus operator is perfectly appropriate. And so the assaults resumed. The mistreatment, the spitting, and the assaulting. And then, of course, some of these folks, if you ask them to wear a mask, they felt that that was a reason for them to become violent.
So, you know, bus operators have to deal with tremendous amount of stress. You know, they're dealing with road rage and angry motorists. It seemed like every longtime bus operator had stories of abuse they had endured on the job. And Lane himself has stories like this.
Yes, very early on in my career. In fact, after I had completed probation, I was attacked outside, right outside the front of my depot, Amsterdam Depot, by a motorist who I had asked to move his car from the front of a bus stop so that I could safely alight an elderly woman. And he took umbrage with my request and came out of his car with that anti-theft device called the club, which is a huge steel bar, and, you know, approached me and attacked me with it. And while I was able to prevail physically in that encounter, that kind of set the tone for what my expectations should be from that point forward.
Please exit through the rear door.
Now, if you think that you can assault a New York City Transit bus operator right in front of his depot with supervisors and other bus operators standing around, if you think that that's okay, you can imagine what some other people may think it's okay. And so we're slowly but surely getting back to how things were before the pandemic came on.
Bus operators are protected by New York state law. Assaulting a bus operator is a felony.
Please exit through the rear door.
During the very worst days of the pandemic, I know as the chief shop steward at the depot, you had a lot of responsibilities. Tell me about what sort of tasks you were performing back then.
My assignments changed slightly. I would operate a bus in the morning. I would operate the M96. And then in the afternoon, I would take the sick list, which is the list of my brothers and sisters who had called out sick. And I would take that list and I would check in and call and try to contact each member on that list just to get some information about their condition and what kind of assistance we could render. And that I would do that up until 6-7 o'clock in the evening.
And what were your coworkers telling you on the telephone when you reached them?
Well, some of them had been exposed. Others were experiencing symptoms. Shortness of breath, and this very dry, raspy cough. They couldn't get out a few words without this cough. Some of them were in pain, and some of them were so scared of the hospitals and of the urgent care centers, they were too scared to go and get medical attention. They were scared that they would enter the hospital for treatment and not ever come back out. And there were a couple of them that I had to coax and plead with to at least go to an urgent care. You know, it was harrowing. And this was after my own father. My own father had passed on the 31st of March.
Tell us a little bit about your father. What was he like?
He was a vibrant man. He loved life. Professional jazz musician. And the thing about this disease is that he appeared to be overcoming it. And then all of a sudden, it just took a turn for the worse. And I didn't know that when he went into Harlem Hospital, on the 24th, we didn't know that we'd never see him again. And we were only able to speak to him because a very kind nurse, the day before he passed, held his phone to his ear so that we could talk to him, but at that point, he wasn't even able to respond. And my case is not unique. There are quite a few of us in Manhattanville Depot who have lost parents and loved ones, but especially parents and grandparents. And anyway, yeah.
We're in Midtown, we're at Central Park South, and we're entering Columbus Circle to go on a northbound trip back up to Harlem. We're right outside the Time Warner Center. It's still weird because look how empty it is now. This is Saturday morning. Normally around this time of the year, it would be full of tourists embarking on their day sightseeing, exploring. There's virtually nobody. There's a few drivers going to work, some cyclists. So as the city's begun to reopen, ridership has increased, but it's still nowhere near the levels that it was pre-COVID.
You know, another thing that we've been hearing about in the news a lot here and that's been getting an increasing amount of attention is the MTA's very dire financial situation, losing something like $200 million a week. And as you know, they've been begging the federal government for help. And they've announced that if they don't get it, there are going to be service cuts, possibly up to 40%, and of course, massive layoffs. What are your colleagues thinking and feeling right now about all of this?
Well, the feeling is that we very quickly have gone from heroes to zeros. And we don't live in a Pollyanna world where we think that the system can be run or maintained without revenue. We're not delusional. We know ridership is down. We know revenue is down. We know that there were massive losses as a result of the pandemic. But on the other hand, we have to continually remind them that, you know, the same people that you're talking about laying off, the same people that you're talking about giving a wage freeze to, the same people that you're talking about inflicting financial and material injury upon, are the same people that helped this city survive. And we're realistic. And we understand that there may be, that we all may have to make or share some measure of sacrifice in terms of, you know, the financial realities that we're presented with. But we should not bear the brunt of the burden of this hardship.
In terms of your job today, in terms of driving a bus now after the pandemic has sort of peaked in New York City, is the experience any different? Do passengers treat you differently?
There are a few that definitely express their gratitude. They thank us when boarding and alighting. There are some that seem to have a profound sense of gratitude and appreciation for the service that we provide and did provide.
And what would a passenger say to you?
They would say thank you. And thank you for your service. And I've had a few people say that to me. Thank you for your service. But for the most part, people just need to get where they need to go. Okay, so now we're making a U-turn. These are the Polo Ground houses. Pretty notorious housing project in New York City. And this is the last stop, the last and first stop for the U-turn.
Terrence Lane is a bus driver in New York City and a chief shop steward for Transit Workers Union Local 100. He spoke with Jennifer Gonerman of The New Yorker. And you can find Jennifer's remarkable profile of Terrence Lane at newyorker.com.
When Ogechi had taken her first baby, a pillowy thing made of cotton tufts, to her mother, the older woman had guffawed, blowing out so much air, she should have fainted.
This month in the New Yorker's fiction podcast, we're featuring a story by Leslie Inyeka Arima.
She'd then taken the molded form from Ogechi, gripped it under its armpits, and pulled it in half. "This thing will grow fat and useless," she'd said. "You need something with strong limbs that can plow and haul and scrub. Soft children with hard lives go mad or die young. Bring me a child with edges, and I will bless it, and you can raise it however you like." When Ogechi had instead brought her mother a paper child, woven from the prettiest wrapping paper she'd been able to scavenge, her mother, laughing the whole time, had plunged it into the mop bucket until it softened and fell apart.
The story was published a few years ago, and it's got the feel of a myth or a fairy tale. The women in the story sew or put together their babies using whatever materials they've got on hand. These babies aren't dolls, though. They're alive, or sort of alive, and eventually they'll turn into flesh and blood children. Arima's story is called Who Will Greet You at Home, and it was read by ZZ Packer.
Mama was not gone for 3 minutes when a young woman walked in. She was stunning, with long, natural hair and delicate fingers and skin smooth and clear as fine chocolate. And in her hands was something that Ogechi wouldn't have believed existed if she hadn't seen it with her own eyes. The baby was porcelain, with a smooth, glazed face, wearing a precious smirk. It wore a frilly white dress and frilly socks and soft-soled shoes that would never touch the ground. Only a very wealthy and lucky woman would be able to keep such a delicate thing unbroken for the full year it would take before the child became flesh. "I am looking for this mama woman. Is this her place?" Ogechi collected herself enough to direct the girl next door, then fell into a fit of jealous tears. Such a baby would never be hers. Even the raffia children of that morning seemed like dirty sponges meant to soak up misfortune when compared with a china doll to whom misfortune would never stick. If Ogechi's mother had seen the child, she would have laughed at how ridiculous such a baby would be, what constant coddling she would need. It would never occur to her that mud daughters need coddling too.
ZZ Packer reads Who Will Greet You at Home by Leslie Inyeka Arima, and she talks about the story on the New Yorker's fiction podcast. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Carrie!
Hello, how are you?
I was trying to think last night if there's a subject on earth that I know less about than K-pop.
Oh.
You know, what's the band that's huge,
BTS.
huge? Okay, I've watched them, then I watched them sing some Beatles song to Paul McCartney. K-pop is the pop music of Korea, and Carrie Batten, a music critic for The New Yorker, has been following its development. And recently, K-pop has found a very solid place in the American mainstream, which is still unusual for bands from non-English-speaking countries. But it takes someone who's been listening to the music intently to tell us what's what. And Carrie Batten always knows what's what. Carrie, how did this all start? Has this been going on for decades and we just never noticed and then it exploded in the United States?
So, not exactly. K-pop is one of the few genres where you can actually pinpoint its origin date, which is 1992, and it emerged after a kind of loosening of censorship laws in South Korea. But it wasn't until just a few years ago that K-pop really broke through in the West. I think most people for a long time, their primary association with K-pop was Psy's Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Do you remember that song?
I do.
Yes, of course. How could you forget it?
That was the earworm of the moment.
That was the earworm of the moment. And I think it has something like 500 billion views or something. But so for several years, and that was kind of like a fluke. It was more of a gimmicky song. And I mean, since then, it's evolved quite a bit. You fast forward a few years, you know, and today you can't really talk about K-pop in the United States without talking about BTS, which is, you know, one of the biggest groups in the world, full stop. And they are a seven-man boy band in South Korea. And if you look at the last couple of years in BTS's career, all you see are all of these milestones that they've achieved in America. You know, they reached the top of the Billboard 100 numerous times. They were at the top of the Billboard 200 album chart, one of the first Korean acts to win an American Music Award, one of the first Korean acts to appear at the Grammys, all sorts of things.
How did they take off here? Why did they take off here?
So I think they took off here because I think a lot of it is algorithmic. Like, I think, you know, once something starts to take off on YouTube, then it's going to get served to more and more people who might be interested in it. And a lot of people think that they're kind of an overnight success, but for a long time, they struggled to make inroads in the American market. And they have this manager and their label head whose nickname is Hitman Bang, and he owns one of the biggest record labels in South Korea. And what he did was he really studied the American market, and he kind of, you know, took a lot of steps to tailor their music to American pop audiences. And BTS was one of the groups that really embraced social media early on. So, you know, publishing YouTube vlogs, going on Instagram, going on Twitter, this kind of thing that a lot of groups in Korea weren't doing at the time.
I have to admit, maybe the first time I saw BTS, and it's quite possibly the most recent and last, was when they appeared on Saturday Night Live.
Ladies and gentlemen, BTS.
Yeah, so this happened last year, and it was the first time that a Korean pop act appeared on SNL, where they did their hit single called Boy With Love.
Their stage presentation is pretty amazing. I mean, if it reminds me of anything, it's of the, not Michael Jackson, but of the Jackson 5 in some way.
Yeah, you can certainly see that, especially with you know, how intensely choreographed they are and how rehearsed they are. And they've also kind of carved out personas for each one of them, sort of in the same way that the Jackson 5 might have. One thing that is also interesting about K-pop boy bands is their sort of interest in presenting as androgynous. Male K-pop stars wear makeup and they dye their hair and they're sort of flamboyant in their own way. And that's something that definitely distinguishes K-pop from a lot of other genres of music.
So there's a documentary on Netflix about a band called Blackpink. What's that all about? Tell us.
Yeah, so another big South Korean group right now is called Blackpink, and they are a girl group. They just put out their sort of biggest major album to date, and it's called The Album. And right now, the big lead single off of that record is called Ice Cream, and it's a collaboration with Selena Gomez. You know, it's very polished, very theatrical, very highly produced. Everybody's kind of having fun in the summer, wearing ridiculous outfits and being very girlish and eating ice cream.
Carrie, who are the big American acts who have kind of collaborated with K-pop acts in order to expand their base and to experiment musically?
So in addition to Selena Gomez, there's also a feature with Cardi B on a song called Bet You Wanna on the album. And the fact that you have Selena Gomez and Cardi B on this record sort of speaks to how big Blackpink is and also how willing these days American pop stars are to collaborate with South Korean artists. You're seeing collaborations all over the place now. You see Halsey with BTS, French Montana with Monsta X. You saw Lil Nas X and Old Town Road doing a remix with BTS. It kind of runs the gamut.
Who else are you listening to in the K-pop realm?
So one group I'm really interested in is another South Korean K-pop all-girl group called ITZY. And there are five of them. And one of their hit songs right now is called Wannabe. And And what I really like about Wannabe is that it's very emblematic of K-pop styles, because I think I read a statistic saying that in the average K-pop song, there are 8 to 10 melody changes, which is absolutely crazy. Usually it's only 3 or 4 in an American pop song. And part of what makes K-pop so fun is that, you know, there are often several songs in one song. It goes from EDM to rap rock to hip hop to slow balladry all in the span of a couple of minutes. And this song really symbolizes that.
It's really interesting. This summer, around the time of the protests following the killing of George Floyd, I remember reading about how K-pop fans were mobilizing on Twitter in support of the protests. Can you explain that phenomenon?
Right. Yeah, you're seeing K-pop fans popping up in unexpected places this summer. They've kind of taken an activist bent to their online presence. And when all of the, you know, the George Floyd protests were happening in early June, what K-pop fans did was they flooded specific hashtags like the White Lives Matter hashtag. And if you clicked on one of these hashtags like hashtag White Lives Matter, what you would see was a kind of endless sea of K-pop dance videos, which was obviously very disorienting to anybody engaging in that content in a kind of political way. Another thing you've probably heard a lot about this summer was the K-pop fans kind of banding together and signing up for tickets to a Trump rally that happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And basically what they did was they flooded the ticket signups so that the number of attendees would be kind of grossly overstated. And what you're seeing here is the way that K-pop fans have kind of learned to gamify their online fandom. They know that they have strength in numbers. They know that they have this intensity. And what they kind of do is rally together and sort of see how they can channel their power online towards a variety of different causes or outcomes.
Do you think it's a phenomenon with legs, particularly in this country?
I do want to say that I think that this idea of K-pop being huge in the U.S. is a bit overstated. One thing about K-pop in the U.S. is it doesn't get any radio play on terrestrial radio. It's all streaming. So it doesn't have the kind of household resonance that a lot of...
How much does terrestrial radio matter any longer for the music business?
I think it still matters. Maybe it doesn't matter technically. I think it is still a bellwether. And I think that you're seeing a lot of the labels in Korea kind of struggle to make it further. And it does kind of go back to COVID, because arena shows is one of the biggest outlets for K-pop acts to infiltrate the U.S. market. You see them in stadiums all over the place. And so without that option, that could be a little bit difficult to keep making inroads. But I certainly think that the algorithms online K-pop has wormed its way into all of them. And so it's not going, you're going to be seeing it online for quite a long time to come.
Well, I've got my YouTube work cut out for me. Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carrie Batten is a staff writer, and she covers music and much more. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. Hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.